today is United States against Gonzalez-Ruiz.
Good morning.
Mr. Wagner.
May it please the court, counsel. I was, as the attorney for the appellant in this case, we were not asked to be here. We did not ask to be here. We were invited. We were invited by the government's appeal on an ACCA issue. And so the juxtapositioning of the parties by local rule is sort of ironic, because the most aggrieved party in this case appears to have been the government on the ACC issue, the difference in sentence. But we did RSVP to the invitation with our cross-appeal on suppression, and I'll address that quite briefly. In this case, the historical facts are not disputed, and the standard of review for the issue that is posited in Mr. Gonzalez-Ruiz's cross-appeal is whether or not, on those undisputed facts, there was either mere acquiescence to a request to search or actual consent. I might summarize it quite easily with, does I guess mean yes? I'm not sure it does. Given the background and the backdrop of the facts that are in the record that are undisputed, it is the defendant's position that that did not rise to the level of consent, but rather was mere acquiescence, going all the way back to the Bumper versus North Carolina decision. Now, I'll end that argument there. I'll note for the court's benefit that I did not come up with, while waiting, any argument how this is related to campaign finance. So I did not review the Supreme Court's decision on that this morning. I could not find any other. I will say that there is a case that I should have sent a supplemental citation on from this circuit from February 26, and I've brought it to the attention of counsel for the appellant. And I'll say that at the outset, on February 26th of this year, this court issued an opinion in U.S. versus Johnson, case 13-3172. I believe it was this panel actually that issued that decision, and I will make reference to that in a moment. But the main event and the main argument in this case is whether or not a conspiracy in which no overt act is pleaded, proven, or required to be proven can rise to the level of a crime that fits within what Justice Scalia has called the Delphic residual clause of the ACCA. Justice Scalia is in a minority, and he wants that to be found void for vagueness, but he's lost that battle, at least at this point. So in the quartet of cases that preceded our argument today and that we look at, the closest thing this circuit has come, the closest case we've come in this circuit to this question is actually Judge Wood's dissent in the Raupp case, R-A-U-P-P, which doesn't really address the issue, and that is whether or not an inchoate conspiracy with no overt act, no actual conduct other than agreement, can be within the category of the residual clause. So other circuits have been relatively split. The most recent supplemental citation the government has given us shows that the Ninth Circuit now believes that the Nevada law, akin to the Massachusetts law, can qualify. The 10th and the 11th and others seem not to. This doesn't seem to be a frequently occurring problem because of the fact that most states require overt acts. But I would ask the question this way. In this court's decision let me say this. The question really is, does the crime on its elements raise the same risk of physical injury as burglary? I think that is a pretty good way to look at it. And I think the Johnson case makes it clear that Begay is limited to those crimes of negligence, recklessness, and strict liability, and that the standard we look at is the one of risk of physical injury. And as the court in Johnson said, it's not the question of the potential risk of serious injury, but the serious risk of potential injury. And so looking at Johnson and taking it under that standard, which is broader, I posit this question. Does the crime, as it is categorically and elementally defined in Massachusetts, which is a common law crime, no less, does it raise any greater risk than possession of a sawed-off shotgun, which this court has held, in contrast to some circuits, is not a crime of violence? And Justice Thomas, in his concurrence in the Sykes case, notes that the reason burglary raises serious risk of potential injury is because of the risk of confrontation. the risk of the sawed-off shotgun has been discussed in the Miller case in this circuit, and yet despite that, it doesn't, in this circuit's view, fit. So when I look at the crime here, I cannot say that it's the same as possession of the sawed-off shotgun, but two people sitting in a room consciously agreeing and affirmatively agreeing that they're going to commit an armed robbery with nothing more doesn't seem to rise to the level of, if you will, actual engagement in physical activity that raises a danger. Now, James, the Supreme Court's decision in James says that an inchoate crime, such as attempted burglary, can be a residual cause crime, but in that case there was an overt act requirement under the Florida law. So there is no case that answers this question, and I think the answer in this circumstance is here there was less risk posed by the agreement of two people to commit an armed robbery with no steps taken whatsoever in furtherance by elements or by the category than someone who is possessing a sawed-off shotgun. So I would respectfully ask this court to hold that the district judge was correct not to hold that this was a crime of violence under the residual clause and to reject the government's appeal. I've already made my argument on the cross appeal, and I'll reserve the rest of my time. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Mr. Sharda.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Mina Sharda for the United States. Your Honor, when the government must prove that a defendant intended to commit an offense that was an assault with a dangerous weapon, when that assault requires an attempt to use some degree of physical force on another person, or it can be demonstrated by an apparent intent to use that physical force, despite the lack of an overt act, is a violent felony under the Armed Career Criminal Act. As the Fourth Circuit noted in the White case, the North Carolina conspiracy to commit armed robbery statute that did not require an overt act requirement, or did not require that there be an overt act, that in that case it was a violent felony under the Armed Career Criminal Act. And the reason is because in that court's opinion, the conspiracy offense cannot be divorced from its violent objectives, and in that case, robbery with a dangerous weapon. Similarly, in this case...
Has there been any effort to figure out empirically what percentage of conspiracies to commit armed robberies lead to injuries to somebody other than the robbers? That was important in Sykes, and of course we then tried to estimate, in our own opinion, in Johnson, what risks were. How about here? Do we know anything about these risks?
Your Honor, I attempted for about a month, month and a half, to try to find some statistical analysis, particularly in light of the Miller decision for the sawed-off shotgun, and was unable to do so. We also tried to contact the appellate division and the mm-hmm. SG's office, and were unable.
Maybe that the FBI just doesn't keep, the FBI and the other people at the Department of Justice just don't keep data in a way that permits this, but... Given the way the Supreme Court proceeded in Sykes and we proceeded in Johnson, it surely would help. Otherwise, we're just left with intuitions, and it's always judicial intuitions are not the most reliable things.
Certainly, the government agrees, Your Honor. It would have been helpful to obviously have some statistics. However, the Sykes Court obviously has indicated that statistics are obviously not dispositive. The statistics that are out there with respect to the specific crimes that are enumerated, as this court indicated in Johnson, is a arguably fairly low risk. The question is if the risk is a serious potential, not a serious, as counsel indicated, risk of physical harm. And in fact, on some of the enumerated offenses, we're looking at anywhere from 1 to 3%. If the court does note in Sykes as well, the Supreme Court had relied in part in its holding on the guidelines in terms of its analysis and its sort of helping inform the decision about whether or not attempted burglary was sufficient. As the court knows, a conspiracy to commit the offenses, including the enumerated offenses in the Armed Career Criminal Act, in the guidelines do actually indicate that one would be a career offender, for instance, which is at least helpful to the court in its analysis of whether it is a violent felony.
In what way is that helpful?
It's helpful in the sense, Your Honor, that it at least informs the court's analysis, as it did in Sykes, that the attempt to commit, the conspiracy to commit a violent felony, at least for guideline purposes, was included. As the court knows, the guideline reference is fairly similar to the ACCA.
But it's not interpreting the Armed Career Criminal Act. That's not the Sentencing Commission's prerogative.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I apologize if that's...
So as an interpretation of the Armed Career Criminal Act, it doesn't provide any help.
It's helpful.
And we're here interpreting whether this falls within the residual clause of the Act.
It's helpful in the sense that, Your Honor, it provides some sort of empirical evidence, at least that in terms for the... For
what's
the
empirical about it?
Well, as the court indicated in Sykes, the guidelines at least also included the attempt of the offenses that were articulated in...
Right, but there's no empirical backing for that, right? As far as we know, it wasn't an empirically backed judgment of the Sentencing Commission. It was just a categorical sweeping of all inchoate crimes into the guideline.
As a commentary that those offenses, and the way I guess I read Sykes, and perhaps it's incorrect, but the way I read it was that it was also a further... reason for why that the analysis was appropriate.
Well, and my question goes to the basis for the guidelines commentary that you're suggesting we draw some help from. And I don't know what the basis for the Sentencing Commission's decision was to do that. It looked to me just to be sort of a categorical judgment that the Sentencing Commission wants all inchoate crimes included, rather than the Commission having done any empirical analysis about the risks presented by these inchoate crimes.
And I guess all I'm merely suggesting, Your Honor, is that in Sykes the court looked to that as well.
I get that, but I'm taking it the next step, which is what we need to do if we're going to meaningfully interpret the Armed Career Criminal Act's residual clause, which is challenging.
Yes, Your Honor, and I guess the other way to look at it then is to also look at the other circuits that have looked at this issue to determine whether or not they are violent felonies. For instance, in Chandler, the most recent decision out of the Ninth Circuit did say, although admittedly a somewhat strange opinion, did say in a per curiam opinion that looking to the underlying offense, at least under current Ninth Circuit law, that the Nevada conspiracy to commit armed robbery offense without an overt act was a violent felony.
And that statute had no overt act requirement.
Correct, Your Honor.
And what was the reasoning?
The reasoning was there was a previous case, Mendez, out of the Ninth Circuit that attempted to analyze the Hobbs Act, and at least. And each of those cases were before the Sykes opinion from the Supreme Court. So the Ninth Circuit felt compelled that at least at this point it needed to say under Mendez, its prior opinions, that it was a violent felony. We think that the analysis is still the same because, as the court indicated in White and in other cases, and as the Supreme Court has indicated, conspiracies in and of themselves are obviously extraordinarily dangerous activities. They, as White said, they form a partnership in crime to achieve a violent objective, and when they intend to achieve that objective, they have substantially increased the risk that their actions will result in serious physical harm to others. And so, from the government's perspective, that conspiracy, when you've agreed with other people to commit a violent act, that whether or not there's an overt act does make it a violent felony because it creates the serious potential of physical harm to others.
Do you label that an attempt?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Are you trying to say that's an attempt, even to have the conspiracy or just an agreement that you're going to do something is enough for a violent crime? Is that can that also be labeled as an attempt? I thought you were trying to say that. I wasn't sure.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that at least that it could, in the sense that because under James and at least in the Florida statute, and I think under Franklin or most attempt statutes, it does require some substantial step. And here, that substantial step, I guess, arguably could be the overt act requirement. And here, there's no overt act requirement. I would say, though, Your Honor, that the fact that you have in this case, in Massachusetts, the prosecution must prove that the defendant intended to commit the offense. So it wouldn't be just a discussion and an agreement, but there has to be sufficient evidence that the defendant intended to commit the object of the conspiracy, and in this case, a violent...
How could there be an agreement to commit a crime without an intent to commit a crime? An agreement is a plan to commit a crime. That is, the statement, it's a present statement of intent. I completely lose me on the possibility that there is a distinction.
I guess, Your Honor, if that was the case, then from our perspective, there wouldn't be jury instructions that would say that they would just say that there has to be an agreement between two individuals to commit the offense. However, the government has to also still prove that there is an intent to do so. Obviously, that would require some facts, more than just discussions amongst co-conspirators to want to commit the offense. Perhaps it would be, from our perspective, if there was two hypotheticals where, in one hypothetical, if an individual is told that there's a conspiracy to commit this violent felony, the armed robbery, I see my time is up. I thank Your Honors.
May I respond briefly with some of about time, but not all that I say?
Yeah, certainly, Mr. Wagner. Your rebuttal time is to use.
Well, I don't have tickets to the White Sox game at 1, so that's not the issue. But I will say this. There were some questions the court raised, and I want to address them. Judge Easterbrook, you asked about statistics. Perhaps the reason there are no statistics available is because this is a very unusual crime. Very rarely do we see prosecutions of conspiracies without action. But that's what we have, a conspiracy, an agreement without action. And Judge Mannion, you asked the question, is that the same as attempt? And it's clearly not. Attempt begins the path, not just says we have an agreement, we have a meeting of the minds, we're going to do this. So we're not there. Judge Sykes, you asked about the background of the guidelines and the commission and how that relates here. Well, it doesn't. And I think that this Court's made that clear in its decision in the Hampton case, which is that the guidelines draw from the commission. But the ACCA does something very different. It takes you from a maximum 10, in this case 3, up to a minimum of 15 years. And there's no cross-fertilization of that particular jurisprudence of the guideline commission commentary. There's no way to know that, and it doesn't help us in this case. So when we cut right down to it, it does come down to the last question, which is, does the fact that two people agree to commit a crime that itself would be violent and do nothing to further that crime, does it really raise the kind of risk, the serious potential risk of physical injury to another? And I mean, the phraseology from Sykes is probably...
Why would an overt act requirement deal with that? I mean, suppose we had an overt act. The overt act was A gave B his gun. Does that increase the probability that the armed robbery will be carried out or be dangerous if it's carried out?
In one very small incremental step, yes. I mean, practically speaking, does it get...
Suppose the conspiracy is formed between A and B.
Yes, sir.
B already has a gun.
Yes, sir.
Right? No gun trades hands, but the arrest is made before there is a crime. In your view, that would not be a violent felony. Case number two, A and B form a conspiracy to engage in armed robbery. B has a gun. As part of this agreement, B gives the gun to A. In your view, that would be an armed and violent felony. But what difference does it make that one of the conspirators gives the gun to the other?
in the practical world, it probably doesn't greatly increase the chance that they're going to commit it. I concede that. But when we're looking at the armed
career... Sounds totally irrelevant.
Well, it is, and this is the struggle that Justice Scalia points to when we try to figure out what does this mean.
Well, look, Justice Scalia may be right, but so far he is a voice in the wilderness.
He is.
We've
got
to follow the majority.
I don't wish to be joining him there. I wish to be joining somebody else somewhere else. But let me see if I can...
But there's my question. If you can't articulate what concrete difference to the dangerousness of the conspiracy a single overt act makes, it's very hard to see why we should give legal significance to the absence of an overt act requirement in the statute.
Well, let me, if I could take your hypothetical one step further, if neither of them had a gun and they've said we're going to commit an armed robbery, it's still a conspiracy to commit an armed robbery and there's not even a gun. I don't have a good answer to your question, and maybe that means I don't prevail here. But I think that what has happened here is the Supreme Court has tried to, and Justices Kagan and Ginsburg have tried to work with the formulation post-Begay and post-Sykes and say, how close is this to really raising a risk? Is that really a distinction? It's the distinction that seems to have been drawn by some circuits. There could, in fact, be an argument, Your Honor, to be honest, that wouldn't even take it there, that it's still a matter of looking at what risk is posed. And because James doesn't say that every attempt is necessarily going to be an ACCA residual clause. So with that, I hope I've lent some small assistance to what is obviously a nettlesome situation, hopefully not to recur. Have a good afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Nice to see you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.